This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. The 45th President of the United States once ran a for-profit college, Trump University, that had to shell out millions of dollars in settlements over class action lawsuits alleging massive fraud. For-profit colleges are a growing industry, with the University of Phoenix and Corinthian colleges as the most recognizable among them. Millions of students in the U.S. are enrolled in schools that generate profits from higher education. But are these institutions really delivering on their promises of education and good job prospects? Or are they simply diploma mills that leave students in debt and still unable to find decent jobs? My guest is Tressie McMillan-Cottom. She is an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's been a columnist for Slate and an online contributor to the Washington Post and The Atlantic. And she herself worked in enrollment at two for-profit colleges and has just written the book, Lower Ed, The Troubled Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Welcome to the program, Tressie.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, before we get into these serious issues that you point out in your book, give us a sense of your personal interaction with the industry. I mentioned you had worked in enrollment, so that point of contact, first contact between the for-profit college and prospective students, you did that at two different colleges?
That is correct. In the book, I talk about the beauty school and the technical school, which are stand-ins for the two for-profit colleges that I worked in, sort of right there at the start of the rise of the for-profit college sector's recent era of rapid expansion, which starts somewhere around the early mid-1990s and runs through the early 2000s, with most people sort of putting the end of that era to right now, actually. And so I worked in enrollment at those two schools, and I talk about how even though they were serving demographically different kinds of students. So overwhelmingly, I dealt with women and women of color at the beauty school. At the technical school, I worked with many more men, many more white students, many more middle class students. And so one of the driving sort of questions for my later research was, how could we say that these groups who had, by just about every other measure that we use to think about such things, race, class, gender, background, had so much that was not in common, was so different from each other, yet they were making remarkably similar decisions about going to school. So my experience working with those students influenced the types of questions I was asking, but it also influenced why I knew to ask those questions of the enrollment process. Because for-profit colleges rely so heavily on tuition to generate that revenue to the tune of $10 to $20 billion a year, depending on the year we're citing, because they rely so much on the point of enrollment, I knew that that was the most important part of the process. So I wanted to sort of what sociologists used to call follow the money, since that's the process that generates all of the tuition revenue, and it is the process by which students are turned into prospects, transformed from prospects to revenue generating, tuition paying students. I wanted to focus on how does that happen and why does it work for so many different groups of people?
So essentially a lot of these are students who don't come from wealthy backgrounds, but they could be middle class. Often they are low income, meaning they might have gone to public schools in districts that were poorly funded, right. Therefore may not have graduated with good enough grades to get scholarships in accredited universities, therefore found that perhaps their only prospects for higher education were these for-profit schools that offer, through their advertising, very sort of glittering promises of job prospects. The ads usually feature beaming people, often people of color, with mm-hmm. diplomas in their hands and graduation hats on, jumping up in the air for joy, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So there are a couple of things about the way the schools position themselves and people's experiences of them that I was very interested in. And the first is For-profit colleges themselves, especially the ones with the larger names, as you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, the University of Phoenix, one time Corinthian, Everest, DeVry, ITT Technical Institute, these are these large publicly traded shareholder corporations that really transform how we do higher education in this country, especially for the poorest among us. They had this really, interesting relationship to what they were selling students, and they were very honest about it in their financial documents, which was they said, "Listen, one of the reasons why we can help you, the investor, make so much money if you invest in us, the for-profit college, is because look at what's happened in the United States. Millions of people are graduating," they said, "from high school who are not prepared for college." So the number one thing that for-profit colleges are responding to as a growth or market opportunity is the fact that in this country, we do know how to graduate students from high school, but we have not figured out how to do so equally, right? We are graduating students who are unequally prepared for college or job going. And that's also about race, class, and gender. The poorest among us tend to be in the least resourced, least competitive K through 12 school systems. Well, that creates a wonderful opportunity for for-profit colleges who can then say, "Listen, just like everybody else in this country, you want to get ahead." And you're hearing the same message about how to get ahead that middle class and upper class people are hearing, which is go to college. But you don't have, as a practical choice, the full array of higher education available to you. There are places in this country, Sonali, where people can graduate from a public K through 12 school system and not meet the minimum admissions requirements for their state flagship university.
Wow.
Right, that mismatch between how we're preparing people has, but it doesn't assuage the demand for a good job, which is what everybody wants. But we are producing at scale people who have no other practical option for getting there.
So there's two issues. One is, of course, that a lot of these folks don't have the money to afford, because if you have somebody with poor grades who graduates from high school, but they are born into a wealthy family, we know often that their wealthy family can make a big endowment to a college and basically buy admission for their child. But isn't the financial incentive for these corporations that run these schools to get at these poor students, isn't it the availability of federal financial aid? Is that the real financial prize?
Absolutely. This is the aim is this, to find large pots of capital in a system where capital, competition for capital is becoming more difficult. So there are only a couple places for profit seeking to sort of go, right? Healthcare, housing, and education. And so we saw what happened when we went after housing, the global recession happened. We've seen what's happened as profit has sort of insinuated into healthcare. And for-profit colleges are an example of that same process just happening in higher education. And in all those cases, what's underpinning it is that, yes, there is a system of finance that makes access to that money both a good incentive and a likely incentive, right? That it will work. So while we increase access to the federal student aid system with the intent of increasing access to college, when we did that without doing all of the other stuff that addresses the inequality that people face in school and in work, all we effectively have done is we've made poverty very profitable for for-profit colleges, right? Because money, guaranteed money, is attached to that inequality.
So, Tressie, how did you get people who might not have been able to get into, say, a community college? How did you get them enrolled in the schools that you worked at? What sort of criteria did they have to meet? Because presumably there have to be some educational standards, and then after education, you have to meet more standards, et cetera. What did these students have to do to get enrolled?
Oh, so that's a great question, Sonali, because I
I mean,
think
did they have
most,
to take an SAT exam just like
right, no,
others have
and
to do?
I think most people, so let's start with how different the process of enrolling at a for-profit college is as compared to what we sort of have in our public imagination as how people go to college. So, college going is so now so part of our culture that even if you've never attended through television and media, you sort of have some idea of how it goes. Like you said, right? You do well, or at least graduate from high school, you take an SAT or some other entrance exam or standardized test, the ACT or et cetera. You might have to take some additional tests at the college level so they can figure out where to place you. We call those placement exams. Then you might go to orientation. You've got a process of selecting your classes over time. You choose a major and then you graduate. That we need to get rid of that idea that that's how college works if we want to understand how for-profit colleges work, because they don't work that way at all. So most of these schools are what we call open access schools, which means by design, they're not meant to have a lot of admissions criteria. The idea being that people who, again, are more likely to have had a negative K through 12 experience may not be prepared for college, but they still have, still deserve a shot at higher education. That's the intent of open access. Many, public schools are also open access, but what it means is that you just have to have a willingness to enroll and the willingness and ability to pay. Okay. So those are actually the primary criteria for enrolling in a for-profit college. The only, with a few minor exceptions, at one school I worked for, I mentioned in the book, at a technical school, there was a sort of placement test, but it failing the test didn't mean that you couldn't enroll, because we allowed the students to take it as many times as they liked, and it was a very basic sort of scholastic sort of exam that made the students sort of feel good about enrolling, but there was never any real risk of them failing it because we allowed unlimited opportunities to take it, oftentimes with the enrollment counselors helping the student to complete it. So that sort of took care of that. Then, once you make that phone call to the for-profit college, a person answers on the other line. And the first thing we would do, someone like me, would be to try to get you to make an appointment to come visit the school. Right? Always within a couple of days of your phone call, no longer than 30, 72 hours in advance. We wanted to capture the person at the moment when they were feeling the most insecure about their economic conditions and the most ambitious. Right? So, you want to get them in as quickly as possible. When you visit a for-profit college on that first visit, you can enroll that day. And in fact, that is the goal. Across
Wow.
the 9 institutions that I did the research, your first invitation to enroll was that very first appointment.
So it's
That
basically in a way to sort of encourage impulse buying type stuff, your
exact.
instant gratification desires.
Yes. It's more, I think, instead of thinking of it as college, the closest analog that I have for it is to think of it as timeshare sales. The timeshare process, right? When you sign the enrollment agreement, you are enrolled, you're a student. And so that can happen within 24 hours.
Wow. So let's talk about whether these colleges actually deliver on anything they promise, because really we should measure them by that standard. If it turned out that these private for-profit colleges were actually giving people what they needed, then more power to them, taking federal aid to educate people who couldn't go elsewhere and actually ending up having these people being able to get good jobs, pay off their debts, etc. Do they achieve, particularly on a personal level for these students, do students graduate with better job prospects than before?
The evidence is still, I mean, so as a social scientist, I have to say the evidence is
Yeah.
mixed officially, but it's not mixed in the positive direction. I mean, the best case scenario from economists now is that there is no negative or positive effect to attending a for-profit
How about
college.
compared to nonprofit colleges?
Compared to nonprofit colleges, there is a negative effect, a slight negative effect to attending a for-profit college, meaning you are more likely to be unemployed when you are unemployed, to be unemployed for longer, and to earn less than similar students at a not-for-profit college. That's the best case scenario is that a for-profit college doesn't make your life worse. And if that's the best case scenario at the extreme amount of public investment that we make in for-profit colleges, my argument is that that's not good enough.
And especially, aren't these students then saddled with debt that they do have to pay off?
Right, whether you have a positive or negative experience in college, the debt is eternal. The debt follows you. And I actually think it's important for all of us to talk about that. While many students in for-profit colleges, especially those I talked to who were in graduate programs, for example, have an extreme amount of debt. I mean, we're talking in excess of $100,000. Even the students who have small, relatively small amounts of debt, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, If they earn that, if they accrue that debt from a for-profit college, they are still more likely to default on that student loan than a student who went for to a not-for-profit college. And we attribute that to the fact that even if you don't graduate from a traditional college, what has historically been true is that you still get some positive return. Your earnings potential increases, even if you just have some credit hours but no degree. In for-profit colleges, we find that credit hours but no degree has no positive effect for the students, which probably makes it near impossible for them to repay loans, even when those loans are relatively small.
Wow.
So even from the small level to to the top level of student loan debt, the debt is a problem for for-profit college students in a very particular way.
So right. So if the net effect for job prospects is mixed, if you look at debt, there seems to be a clear net negative
Yes,
effect, because
that's correct.
how can you pay off the debt if you are still unable or just as unlikely to get a job as you did before going to college? So all you've
Exactly.
essentially done is gone into debt from the US government to line the pockets of shareholders that profit from these institutions.
What we're looking at here is basically the mass transfer of public money to the private sector through individuals who have almost no other real practical choice for upward social mobility.
Right. So how do these institutions track with the state of the economy? Do you find that for-profit institutions flourish when we have greater income inequality and just in general a worse economy?
Yes. With some stabilizing that started to happen around the early 2000s, and my argument about that is that's because the cycles of recession and growth have become both shorter
Right.
and more narrow. So, as everyone said, we don't recover from recessions the way that we once did. Like right now, we're considered to be in a period of recovery, but as millions of Americans can tell you, they don't feel recovered. Right? The lingering effects of the global recession are still there in depressed housing, competition for jobs, unemployment, and more importantly, underemployment. And I think it's the underemployment number that's especially the number that for-profit colleges track to. Unemployment is one thing, and that I think is intuitive for us, right? It makes sense that if people are unemployed, they'll go to school. But I think the real economic indicator of the sort of stability and growth of for-profit colleges in the new economy is about how many of us are increasingly underemployed. Underemployed, meaning we're not working at the level that we could given our experience and our education and our willingness to work. So that's being either part-time when you could be full-time. In a lower level job than the one you've trained for, being in a service job as opposed to a professional class job, and having very few opportunities to be promoted. Well, that is the new economy, right? That's the future that they're telling us to embrace when they say things like on-demand jobs or the gig economy and how we all need a gig. Well, education in a gig economy is about people who are the most vulnerable in that gig economy not wanting to have a gig. They want a job. And
Right.
they think the only way to get there is to get a credential. And that's really, to me, the indicator how many of us are underemployed.
Right. You have a chapter in your book entitled Jesus is My Backup Plan. Tell me about this chapter and what you mean by that.
So one of the things that came up a lot in doing my research was how many people, very smart people, very well-credentialed and well-educated people, said things to me like, well, yeah, even if they have some debt or they have some negative experiences, that was the choice they made. They made a choice, right? This is the rational choice model. And the students that I speak to in that chapter, Jesus is my backup plan, it comes from one of the people I interviewed who, when I asked her what was she going to do if her current stint, she'd been to a for-profit college four other times in her previous, over the course of her life, each time trying to improve her economic outcomes. And she was enrolled in yet another program that at the time was failing. It was in one of the schools that was going out of business. And when I spoke to her, she had no idea that it was in trouble. She was struggling with her math classes, hoping to become a health technology assistant, right? One of these hospital health aides, allied health positions. And when I asked her, what are you going to do if this doesn't work out? And she said, I said, what is your backup plan? And she said, oh, Jesus. Jesus is my backup plan. And I thought that was great because for almost everybody that I talked to in their own way, what they understood as having a quote unquote choice really was not a choice at all. And that's what they were saying, that this is sort of my last line of defense, going to this program, taking individual responsibility for myself. And because there is no social safety net to catch me, should this not work, truly, the only backup plan many people have is sort of their faith in something larger. And that was true. That was the commonality, I think, for everybody that I spoke to.
Tressie, it is such a predatory industry, it seems. And one of the things that occurs to me, and I'm not sure if you write about this necessarily in your book, but you might be thinking about it, is we live at a time today when we have a president in power who has taken advantage of a very desperate people in this country by making them all sorts of promises about, the miracles he's going to work on the economy. Many of the people that voted, although not all, many of them, were lower income folks who really believed that Trump was going to save them. This is a man who ran his own for-profit university, so we know that, he has made promises that can't be delivered on. And yet, college really should be that place for most of us, where we learn especially how to do critical thinking, how we learn especially to tell truth from lies, to tell, to research things that we're getting into, to look up facts, to be able to tell the difference between facts and fiction. And it feels as though the massive inability to have critical thinking is tied up with the flourishing of for-profit colleges and the fact that so many people are left behind.
Oh, absolutely, Sonali. At every level of that, I agree with you. So on the first level, let me just say that yes, the same insecurity that produced, I think, a populist candidate like Donald Trump is the exact same insecurity that has produced millions of people willing to take out student loan debt for every type of certificate in the for-profit college sector that you can imagine. It's the exact same process. And driven as much by gender, by the way, because more women have chosen to make that choice than have working class and poor white men, for example. And while we see a lot of that sort of negative economic anxiety being expressed from poor and working class white men in favor of Trump, I think it's in part because they didn't pursue even the limited educational opportunities that were available to them. Not to say that they've been better off if they had, but they didn't seem to. Then the other side of this that I think is really interesting, and that I did actually try to link to some extent in the book, and that I do think about quite a lot, is the political interest in supporting the development of a private sector, for-profit education sector. The conservatives are very much in favor of this. In fact, the official GOP platform says, we need to increase these for-profit options at education K through 16, meaning kindergarten through college, because it provides important competition to public higher education, and can reskill the American, labor force, right? Other conservatives go even further. People who tend to consult with the GOP, for example, on their official platform, people like the organization ALEC, who in their platform on higher education is even more explicit. They state, yes, we are in favor of for-profit higher education models, not just because they will reskill the labor market, but because they develop skills in the labor market without also inculcating people with critical thinking developed by things like wasteful humanities, social science, gender studies, and race studies programs. They are making a cultural argument that the real problem with public higher education isn't just that it won't quote unquote upskill the labor market, but that it won't do it without also teaching these critical thinking skills, which some people on the right see as the real ideological threat to conservatism. And I think that's driving as much as the economic indicators, and I think those are critically important. I also think the ideology matters.
Well, Tressie, I very much enjoyed your book. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and spending this time with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My guest is Tressie McMillan-Cottom. She is an assistant professor of sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University. She's been a columnist for Slate and an online contributor to the Washington Post and the Atlantic. And she herself worked in enrollment at two for-profit colleges, which she discusses in the book that we've been talking about, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletters. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.